That was a good little workout. You get a lot of exercise when you sing, you know. All right. The midway spot, which is neither dry nor wet. We're going to work on the midway spot now. See, what had we just finished with here? Yeah, it is the most important in the book from the standpoint of the average student. And this rule cannot be understood where there is no soul contact, nor can the magical force of the soul work out in manifestation upon the physical plane until the meaning of the rule's esoteric phrases has been somewhat wrought out in the inner experience of the magician. Okay. This is the white magic part of the cosmic fire rule. So you just have to kind of get it from the screen. Most true aspirants, when he uses that kind of qualifier, you know. Whoops. Okay. Most true aspirants are now at the midway spot and can either drown and so make no further progress in this life. And by the way, when he says drown at this point, he doesn't mean the occult drowning where the devas drain all of your water. See?
No.
He just means being overcome by emotion. So it's not occult drowning in the severe sense. They can either drown. Here, you're gonna get a choice now, okay? Stand and so hold the ground gained. That's choice number two. Or become true practicing magicians, eventually, efficient in white magic, which is based on love, animated by wisdom, and intelligently applied to forms. I think that's a very beautiful idea of how white magic works. It's rooted in love. It's inspired or given life by wisdom. And the appreciation of what forms are and how to intelligently apply energy and force to forms, this is required. Okay. So you have a choice. And I suppose we can't avoid it because, you know, we may say, well, look, white magic isn't really the area in which I'm specializing in occultism. I'm more interested in healing or I'm more interested in psychology. Okay, fine. But you can't help but be an unconscious creator. You can't help it. So you might as well, we all might as well know what we're doing because we're going to be creating all the time anyway. Every word we speak, every thought we think is a form of creation. We will therefore divide this rule into several parts, more easily to study it and take them up step by step so as to grasp their application to the average life of the probationary disciple and to gain a wise understanding of their wide implications. What is a probationary disciple? Remember how he differentiated in yesterday's discussion between an aspirant and a probationary disciple? What was the difference? What we could do is do you remember what the difference was at all? Do I? Take a look at the end here of the meditation from this morning. Are you the battered, earth-weary aspirant, struggling with desire, glamour, ambition, and a sensitive emotional body? Or are you the experienced probationary disciple, struggling not only with your own nature, but with the forces in the veil of illusion? So that is another step, isn't it? It's not just you all wrapped up in your own problems, but there are forces around you with which you are also struggling. Or are you the battling disciple? Note, he uses a lot of battle, doesn't it? Battered, battle and all the rest. Are you the battling disciple facing with courage the forces arrayed against you and the forces of illusion arrayed against the group to which you belong? These discriminations. Aspirant, probationary disciple, disciple, and finally accepted disciple, dealing with everything above, plus the black forces arrayed against the elder brothers. So he chooses actually to discuss this in, he chooses to discuss this on the level of the probationary disciple. And he uses the word experienced when discussing this disciple, not just wrapped up in himself, but also dealing with the forces in the environment which are illusory, glamorous, and so forth. But not necessarily defending the group yet. Still somewhat the individual in that respect. Okay. How do you feel? I mean, do you feel like... You feel to have passed the stage of strict aspiration, the way he describes it. I would say, wouldn't you say that we have passed that? We're not just battered, glamorous, and all the rest of it. What does he, how does he describe it? Battered, earth-weary, tired of living, having your last incarnation, you know, struggling with your desires, your glamour, your ambition. I think maybe we are beyond that. But, you know, we have to decide about the next phase, because that includes a lot of people, because they're being tested, aren't they? That's what it means. Put on probation to see. Now, technically, I think, it depends. DK does it a different way. Sometimes he takes the probationary degrees and he takes them up to the first initiation. And then at the first initiation, you become technically a disciple, a chela in the light, something of that nature. And then you go on for some incarnations until you become an accepted disciple. But other times, he makes you think, here's the aspirant, and the probationer goes through the first initiation, and only when he becomes an accepted disciple is he truly a disciple. And not just a probationer. And that's another way of looking at it. Now, all of the students that he was dealing with were technically accepted disciples because he accepted them. And most of them had not taken the second initiation. It was the initiation for which they were preparing by and large. Maybe one or two here and there had taken the second initiation. For some, you could see it was fairly far ahead. But even one of the disciples who wasn't doing very well, he was, the DK promised, he was a Taurus. DK said, your next life, you're going to be a Scorpio. And you're going to go through the terrific trials and tests of Scorpio. Made it sound like it was the second initiation. So that's pretty much where they were at that point. Anyway, he chooses to pitch this white magic thing at the probationary disciple, experienced, working upon himself, but also working a little bit in the environment, obviously serving. Okay, so we will divide the rule into several parts, take them up step by step, and apply them to the average probationary disciple. Do you get the feeling like you're being tested? You know, in a way, think about it, those tests go on until you achieve mental polarization, somewhere between the second and third degree. So in a way, the words probationary, it lasts a long time. Even when you become a pledged disciple, the word probationary still applies. I would say, when you pass the temptations in the wilderness, the word probationary can no longer apply. He also uses certain words. He says that when you are a first or second degree initiate, you are what he calls a probationary initiate. And that the true initiation, of course, is the third degree. All right, these divisions are the response of the astral elementals and the consequent ebb and flow of the waters. So they respond by coming or going, going or coming. The dangers of the midway spot, its nature and the opportunity it affords, and the place where magic is worked out, wrought. Okay, so we're now going to study the three points. The first point. It is summed up in the words, the Agni Suryans respond to the sound, the waters ebb and flow. The situation might be stated in the following terse terms. Terse means very short and to the point. The rules already studied convey the truth about the magician. And he goes through the steps that we have taken. Okay. This is a very good summary, by the way. A good summary of what we have studied so far. The soul has communicated with its instrument in the three worlds. First rule. The man on the physical plane recognizes the contact, and the light in the head shines forth. Sometimes recognized, sometimes unrecognized by the aspirant. And let's say DK did not discuss this. Step two. But he discusses it elsewhere. Or rather, rule two. Number three. The soul sounds forth its note. A thought form is created in consonance with the united meditation of the soul and the man, his instrument. So we have actually four notes sounding. We discussed the synchronization of three notes before, and here he adds the man sounding his note. The soul is sounding note, the devas have the note, the thought form has its note, the man has his note that he sounds for. Okay. So, you know, this is the rule that said the energy circulates, the point of light, the product of the labors of the four waxeth and groweth. The myriads gather round its glowing warmth until its light recedes, its fire grows dim, then shall the second sound go forth. Okay, the next one. This thought form, embodying the will of the ego or soul, is what you're creating. It's what you're creating now in your life. The will of the ego or soul, cooperating with the personality, takes to itself a triple form, constituted of the matter of all three planes and vitalized through the activity and by the emanations of the heart, the throat, and ajna centers of the white magician, the soul in conjunction with its instrument. So, why are you using the heart, the throat, and the eye, or the ajna center? Why do you do this? It's all about steady contemplation, right? And this is the word. Via the heart, the throat, and the eye comes vitalization. With the heart, what do you do? Your heart center
purifies.
You purify the astral vehicle so that, quote unquote, the condition of the waters is acceptable. Through the throat, what do you do? What do you do, Martha? Did you say?
Speak the right tone.
Yes, you sound the protective mantras that you are given, and you create that insulation of air atoms around yourself and around your thought form. You are protected. Through the ajna center, through the power of contemplation, what do you do?
See.
You
see.
See and strengthen. Your gaze itself strengthens the thought form. You know, and somewhere here, DK tells us that when the soul looks at you, its contemplative gaze upon the personality strengthens the personality. So you can say, well, I'm just looking. Okay, I'm just looking. No, the gaze actually has an effect. The contemplative gaze has a vitalizing, strengthening effect. Okay. So, the thought form embodying the will of the ego or soul cooperating with the personality gets a triple form and is vitalized by the emanations of the heart, throat, and ajna. Okay. And this is the key. Contemplation leads to transmutation. That's the idea. And somewhere it says this, I'm trying to remember where it is, but we'll probably come to it. The fifth rule. And this is a very good description, because the rule itself is a little bit abstruse. Listen to the rule. Three things engage the solar angel. It's this one. It's rule six, actually. Why should that be? The devas of the lower four feel the force when the eye opens. They are driven forth and lose their master. And here's the explanation of this. Explanation of rule six. The personality sheaths, each with its own individual life, feel they are losing their power. And the battle between the forces of matter and the force of the soul is violently renewed. What does this tell us about human beings? If you feel yourself getting weaker, what's likely to follow? It's clear, isn't it? If you feel you are losing your power, you may suddenly renew your attempt to be what you thought you were. Oftentimes when groups are fading out, I think that's what's happening to six or eight groups right now in the world. They feel they are losing their power, and therefore they violently renew the assertion of what they believed themselves to be in the past. It's just the last blaze before they go out.
They go supernova.
That's it? In a lower sort of way, they go supernova. That's right. The real supernova is, of course, the fourth initiation. But they're not there yet, and neither are we. Okay, so they are driven forth and lose their master, but not without a fight. The battle must be fought out on the astral plane, and we'll decide three things. And let's see if these things are being decided in our life. Whether the soul will, in any one life, for some life holds the critical stage, be the dominant factor, and the personality from henceforth be the servant of the soul. So what do you think in your own case? Is the quote-unquote ancient domination of the personality finished in your own life? Do you think? Do you think so? Maybe not, huh? Maybe not. That's not ancient. And it's not domination. Third, ancient personality, maybe that'll do it. Maybe it's not ancient, it's just, maybe it's just domination. Third, initiation, let's see if I can find it. At the stage of initiation, the domination continues. Domination of the third act. For some reason, I'm getting one of the words wrong. Ah, I got it now. I believe it's this. Ancient authority. Initiation 3. Freedom from the ancient authority of the threefold personality, marking a climaxing moment in the history of all initiates. Ancient authority. So that's the question. In our life, does the personality still have authority? And the chances are, yes. There will be those moments. Because we have not necessarily taken the third degree. Matter of fact, we haven't taken the third degree. Okay, so what will be the decision? The battle will decide three things. Will the soul be dominant, or will the personality, and will the personality be the servant of the soul? Well, maybe for many of us, the personality is more or less the servant of the soul at this time. More or less. But there's still some stuff to clean up. It will decide whether the astral plane is no longer the plane of illusion, but can become the field of service through the expression of love, through the astral body. Okay. Now that would be the second initiation, if love could really be expressed in that way, in service through the astral body, plus having spiritual intelligence and mental illumination. It will decide whether the man can become an active cooperator with the hierarchy, able to create and wield mental matter, and so work out the purposes of the universal mind, which are prompted by boundless and infinite love and are expressions of the one life. Sounds very high, doesn't it? But very beautiful. It sounds like this battle on the astral plane has very important results, depending on how it goes. Do you feel that you are battling in any way on the astral plane in your life at this time?
Mm-hmm.
What characterizes the battle? What's it about? What are the counter pulls?
Personality traits over soul traits.
Certain personalities.
You're losing out to your personality.
So certain personality traits are still asserting sometimes.
Sometimes.
And yes.
It's also about being focused in the personality, like forgetting the group, so it's through the group that the love is coming in.
Yes, forgetting the group. In other words, the personality may be just fine in a certain way, but you're forgetting the group.
Sometimes you go over in the personality way of looking at things. Maybe it's when you are hurt, or when you have pain. Maybe I think that's the easiest way.
Expediency, they call it. It's kind of a third-ray way compared with a second-ray way. Yeah. Trying to think, opposing desires, contrary desires on the astral plane. The two paths face the solar angel, and they pull in two different directions. Has the astral plane become for you a field of service? Think about that for a minute. I mean, who are you working with? Right? Are you working with people who have astral plane issues, sentient body issues? Are you working as an astrologer, as a counselor, as a psychologist? Are you working with people who are troubled, which is a good way of describing focused in the astral body. Trouble. So, what's really interesting when you look at the group of psychologists, considered in the large sense, who have a close connection with theosophy, he says, they tend to be the more theosophically inclined. The psychologists work through their head center, their throat center, their heart center, and their solar plexus. So then has the astral plane become a field of service if you're working through your solar plexus.
Mm-hmm.
And when you use your solar plexus, how do you use it when you're serving? What do you do? I mean, in some ways it's obvious, of course. But, you know, you're serving. And your solar plexus as a instrument is being used.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing?
And you feel the pain from other people?
You are...
Yeah, you're sensitive to other people.
Yeah. You're sensitive to their personal issues.
Yeah.
Through the solar plexus, right? And you might say you're sympathizing, empathizing, you're let's just say, you're often able to feel what they feel.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily a heart reaction. You can actually empathically, sympathetically, you can feel. Same body.
Mm-hmm.
You can feel.
You can do it to the humanity, to the
yeah.
humanity,
yeah.
listening to what's going on.
Exactly. You get the feel of where...
Detached at the same time.
Yes, but you have to know what it is, and then you have to be detached. Yeah, but how? What puts you in rapport with what it is, with all those conditions? Yes.
It's so the plexus is you're working with the instincts.
Yes.
The basic instincts of being a creature. You're because the creature is instincts that make you react with crying or with with sorrow
Exactly. Yeah. All those things. In other words, what condition is the astral body of humanity in? What condition is your client in? You know, where are they at? And can you feel that? And then you can do something about it. So at least you're on rapport with the troubled astral body of humanity. Rapport is very important here.
I thought it was essential, though, to try and, if you like, dim that and raise it up to the heart.
Sure. But the question, absolutely.
You have a strengthened and purified heart and a less pronounced plexus then.
Well, that is, you know, the psychologists have all those four centers. The heart center is very important for psychologists. But remember what he says, the heart center is a group organ.
Mm.
He says what devastates most disciples, and certainly most people, is the very sensitive solar plexus. That's what is really key in their psyche.
Mm.
Even disciples, they are devastated by the solar plexus.
Mm.
Anyway, apparently we can use the solar plexus to put ourselves en rapport with other people so we're in a position to help them transmute.
I think even the physical body, because I know if I've overworked mine actually hurts.
Uh-huh, okay. You mean your solar plexus or your physical body?
No, the physical body in the solar plexus area begins to, there's pain.
Right, and I imagine that as a counselor you run into a lot of stuff.
Yes, exactly. I try not to do it so much now.
Yeah, right.
I realized that was totally wrong.
Well, you know, it's a place where we have been, and then we realize something.
Mm.
I felt that way about Italian opera after a while. I had my last opera, you know what I mean? It's just, I felt whenever I had to direct an opera, I had to take a breath for about 6 weeks and go underwater.
Mm.
So after a while, I said, where is the mom? You know, the mind was no longer there, you know. I had to live in the world of violent emotions, and I had to make the actors convincing, which meant I had to let all that go through me. But after a while, I forgot that I had a mind, and I enjoyed it. Well, it was a long time ago. So, okay, there's a battle. Is your soul the dominant factor? Can you serve through the astral plane, and can you actually work with the hierarchy as a mental creator? I thought this is interesting. When you hear the word universal mind, what does it mean to you? How do you think of it? Where do you place it, and so forth? Universal mind.
Isn't the mind of the monad?
Well, you could say so. I think there are several possibilities. First, we can say the atomic plane. But the universe is the life expression of the solar logos. So what is the mind of the solar logos? That's universal mind. And the mind of the solar logos, I believe, is found on the cosmic mental plane. Cosmic mental plane. And the solar angels are inspired from the cosmic mental plane. Because when you hear words like boundless and infinite love, it sounds a little bit more than the atomic plane, where three minds unite. It almost sounds like the higher mind of the solar logos, to me, universal mind. Anyway, for me, it sounds like the entirety of the cosmic mental plane. But, of course, we're not going to be contacting the cosmic mental plane directly, although maybe the Buddha did. So, we have the cosmic mental plane working out on the cosmic physical plane through the logoic plane, the atomic plane, and the monastic plane. Those receive the higher impulses. And we have to be sensitive, let's just say at the very least, sensitive to the triad, the mental parts. Now, how many mental parts are there to the triad? And this is a trick question. How many mental parts to the spiritual triad? And I want to say three. Okay? We have the abstract mind. We have the transcendental mind. And we have the... I don't know what to call it exactly. It's... spiritual mind, or nirvanic mind, the mind of the Buddha. That's the atomic plane, transcendental mind, is intuition, is the Buddhic plane, abstract mind is the higher monastic plane. All of them are sensitive to the cosmic mental plane in some degree.
Doesn't Sanat Kumara function on the cosmic
Sanat Kumara is another name, in a way, for our planetary logos, an extension of our planetary logos. And indeed, Sanat Kumara has a focus on the cosmic mental plane. But in a way, Sanat Kumara is functioning etherically now, isn't he? He's functioning in the cosmic ethers. He's taken a position in the higher four ethers of the cosmic physical plane. And not only that, but Sanat Kumara has a resonance on our normal systemic ethers, because that's where one outpost of Shambhala is found, in the Gobi Desert. DK tells us, as soon as our eye can begin to perceive etherically, we will see Shambhala. So that's obviously not the high Shambhala on the cosmic ethers, but it is a kind of a reflection of Shambhala in a certain place on our globe in the systemic ethers. So Sanat Kumara definitely does have a cosmic mental focus in one way. It's very interesting, who is Sanat Kumara, and I will just say that in order to understand that, we have to understand the mind-born idea that we were talking about yesterday. Sanat Kumara is a mind-born son of the planetary logos. He is the planetary logos in one type of emanation. So So the planetary logos has extended an emanation of himself into certain scheme, into a certain chain, certain globes in that chain, and then onto another chain, ours, and to certain globes in that chain, and it's all the planetary logos having extended himself into those low areas by the process of emanation. So that's why the Tibetan oftentimes seems to confuse Sanat Kumara with the planetary logos, because really they're one and the same. But Sanat Kumara, when we use those terms, is not the entirety of the planetary logos.
Is it similar to what you were saying about DK, that he can, you know, manifest anywhere? If he wants to appear, he will. He'll use a vehicle in which to do it.
Various masters can put their presence forth into different
locations. So
I would say it's an analogy, except that for Sanat Kumara, he sustains that emanation for millions of years.
Yes. And works a higher term of spiral.
Yes, and works through it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think, you know, remember that we have to learn to reproduce ourselves. And I remember an old book by Manly Hall, who was quite a scholar, you know. And he showed a Buddha sitting in meditation, and all around him, radiating from him, were countless little Buddhas who were the image of himself.
Sometimes you see that with a Buddha. A little Buddha inside.
The Buddha inside, mm-hmm. In this case, it was all around, and there were maybe 10 of them.
Mm-hmm.
10 different extensions of himself into instruments that could go in different places. But who is it, after all? Who is the emanation? The emanation is the being who emanates the emanation.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no, you can't suddenly say, cut, this is the emanation, this is the being.
No.
In the same way, you have a candle, you light another flame, but the essence of the fire came from here. You can't really say they're totally separate things.
Yeah.
It has a connection with the source. So we have to learn how to do that. Now, remember that DK sometimes says a disciple can become an outpost of the master's consciousness. Same thing. The master is the master, but the master is also in the disciple, in the disciple's consciousness, aware of what the disciple is sensing, feeling, knowing. He can project himself into the disciple's consciousness. What does it mean to be overshadowed? Suddenly the Christ is overshadowing some disciples. How many? Could be quite a few. The Christ doesn't stop being the Christ, but his presence is in these other disciples, extended into them by a process of emanation. He puts a portion of himself forward, but only a portion. He doesn't put his entirety forward. I think that's interesting. Because if he put his entirety forward, I don't know how he'd do it anyway, it couldn't bear it, because it's going down into a lower level. It wouldn't be allowed. So if Sanat Kumara shows up on some of the lower planes, it is a version of the planetary logos reduced in potency from what the planetary logos is on his own highest level. If you can get in your mind the doctrine of emanation, then a lot will be solved about how a certain hierarchy of beings is really the same being. And I showed you that picture of the 171717. It's called Paragon. It's an important line of thought. And it was considered by the church, of course, a heresy, naturally. Why is this? Why should emanationism be a heresy?
Because God was always meant to be very separate from man.
Exactly.
God was not born in man. God was very
exactly.
separate.
Exactly. Exactly. God is God and man is man. And if you say God is man and I am God, watch out. So this was one of those heresies that was stamped out. But in the early days when Christianity and Hellenism were still making a kind of a merging, when Gnosticism was popular, the idea of emanation could unite with the Christian ideas. But then the ignorant people won out in the last analysis, the concrete mind got more concrete, and the connection between the high and the low was no longer perceived, and then was finally outlawed and became rejected, heresy.
Do the Cathars, I think they were they believed, didn't they, that God was within them?
I don't know the history. Are they it's kind of an early medieval order or
and
sect?
They were absolutely routed by the Catholic Church,
mm-hmm.
because they were healers, good people, and the people actually were drawn to them because they said, hey, these are leading ascetic lives.
Exactly.
These people are living on very little and doing good. And look at the priests, they're
the magnetism of good people threatens the church coffers.
Mm-hmm.
So, the Catholic Church is a first-rate organization.
Mm-hmm.
We're told that it has the soul ray of power and the personality ray of financial manipulation,
mm-hmm.
third ray. It has the sixth ray mind and the sixth ray astral body, so it's totally rigid. And the formal seventh ray physical body. Those are the rays of the Catholic Church.
It seems to be crumbling now, though, doesn't it?
I think, it has to clean house, as D.K. said.
Mm.
So the rays can change.
Mm.
All right, anyway, this is the crux of the entire situation. And when the man has mastered the forces opposed to him, he is ready for the second initiation, which marks the release of the soul from the prison of the astral body. Henceforth, the soul will use the astral body and mold desire into line with divine purpose. In other words, you, in a way, what can you say? You choose your desires. Make sure, said Master Moria, your desires are goal fitting, or goal fit. So this is the objective of so many of us, the second initiation, and once we have achieved this, progress is really fast. As he says, in one life you can take the second, third, and fourth initiation, which I always find an astonishing thought. Knowing people as I think I know them, knowing myself as I think I know myself, the thought of taking the second, third, and fourth initiation in one life is astonishing to me. But he definitely says it is so. And I have a feeling that things... Oh, my granddaughter's online. Okay, I have a feeling... Small world. I have a feeling that... the circumstances provided in the next 15 years may be of a nature to assist a forcing process.
Mm.
That is my guess.
Mm.
People don't like a forcing process while they're going through it, but they like it afterwards.
Mm.
So it is of value for the student to know where he stands and what his particular problem is. The average man is learning the control of the physical body and the organizing of his physical plane life. So this, you could say, it's like what you would call application to the first initiation. Seventh ray, organization, getting your life in order. This is all part of the first degree. The student on the probationary path is learning a similar lesson in relation to the astral body, its focus, its desires, and its work. So, organizing and controlling your astral body. Okay. These things bear repeating. You know, we think we know them, but organizing and controlling your astral body. The student, notice he just skipped over disciple. He went from probationary to accepted. Did you see how he did that? He really, that's really what he thinks. Discipleship is this big term that covers a long period of time, probationary, accepted, even initiation. Still, you're still a disciple. The student on the path of accepted discipleship has to demonstrate this control and begin to discipline the mind nature and so function consciously in the mental body. Ray 3 and 5, Saturn and Mercury, etc., are very important in this path of accepted discipleship. You know, you sometimes say, well, Venus is Ray 5. But like we said yesterday, Mercury and Saturn are the planets of discipleship, and Mercury has a Ray 5 monad. It's a profoundly Ray 5 planet. But if we go still deeper, we will find the monad to be Ray 3. I believe. That's my speculation. And therefore, very tied in with the moon, and therefore very tied in with the previous Ray 3 solar system. It's almost like, as the Buddha was related to the previous solar system, so is Mercury. As Venus is related to the present solar system, so is the Christ. So there's kind of an analogy where the Buddha is Mercury and the Christ is Venus. And I think that is borne out in some ways when you look at the relationship between Master KH and Master DK. Master DK is Mercury and Master KH is Venus. I mean, you know, that's a little simplification, obviously. And you will see the people who relate more to one of these or another. The ones connected with DK tend to be quite highly cognitive, mental, and they use the mind quite a bit in an analytical manner, and the ones related to Master KH have more of the Venusian love vibration. Very illumined, but not so cogitative, if I can say that. But remember that Master DK's ashram is in Master KH's ashram. So it's all in the family, right? Okay. The work of the initiate and the adept grows out of these achievements, and they need not be dealt with here, but the initiate and the adept depend very much on the first and seventh ray. In other words, there's three paths. Let's call it the path of aspiration. It's ruled by Ray 6 and Ray 4. The path of discipleship is ruled by Ray. What Ray? We just went over it.
3 and 5.
3 and 5. The path of initiation.
Yeah, 1 and 7.
That's it. With Ray 2 synthesizing the whole thing. So that's a good way of perceiving, isn't it? You know, you look at people. What are they doing? Are they aspiring? Are they struggling? Blah, 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 you know? Ray 6 and Ray 4. It's aspiration. It's probationary discipleship. Are they thinking? Trying to bring in the illumined mind. That's the path of discipleship and accepted discipleship. Are they wielding power? 1 and 7. The path of initiation.
Until though you're always an aspirant, aren't you?
Sure, absolutely. Even the solar logos is an aspirant to a certain level of achievement. You're always a disciple, you're always an aspirant, and to some you're always an initiate. Because you have entered things they haven't entered yet. Any person who goes into a new territory is an initiate. they have initiated a new phase of life. So these terms have many different applications, and we're trying to understand them more or less how Master DK uses them and perceives them. The battle is spread over quite a series of lives. Maybe you need some water, huh? Water! We don't have... But let's see, when did we have our water... That was 1 year ago, wasn't it? We were all afloat in water. Everybody had their pitcher on their thing, you know.
Have you stopped that now?
I don't want to say too much, you know, because...
He changed his battlefield anyway.
Oh, different battlefield. Okay. The battle is spread over quite a series of lives, but in some one life it becomes critical. The final stand is made and Arjuna triumphs in the fight. The final stand against the mobilized forces of the personality. And Arjuna, is the soul in incarnation, counseled by Krishna, the soul. There's three of us, right? Our personality, the soul in incarnation, and Krishna, the soul. Arjuna triumphs in the fight, but only by letting Krishna assume the reins of control. It's like this. Okay, Dad, you drive. That's after you've had a few close calls, you know. Whoa, keep that chariot on the road. Okay. By learning mind control and the revelation of the form of God. Now, if you haven't read the Bhagavad Gita, or I have to recommend the one I read. It's the one by Edwin Arnold, the Bhagavad Gita by Edwin Arnold. It's a poem, like I said. It's a poem about Krishna on the battlefield. And there come those several pages where Krishna reveals the one form of God in all of its multiplicity and all of its oneness. That's really worth reading. It's very beautiful.
That's one of the five books.
Well, you know, actually I can count four at the moment. The New Testament, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, the Bhagavad Gita, and the Viveka Kudamani by Shankara, the crest jewel of discrimination. Now, the crest jewel of discrimination. Discrimination rules the fourth initiation. And if you read that book really carefully and well, it shows you what you need for the fourth initiation taken in the Eastern way, which is not necessarily a crucifixion, it's a renunciation. And the discrimination offered in the fourth degree is ruled again by two familiar planets. What are they? Yes, take a guess. Discrimination. Two planets rule discrimination at the fourth degree. And then we want to say, well, discrimination between what and what? What? Viveka.
And who is Saturn?
It's again Saturn and Mercury.
Mm-hmm.
Showing up again, not just for the disciple, but at the fourth degree. And the discrimination is between Manas and Buddhi. It's between being in the cosmic dense physical body and the cosmic etheric body. That's the discrimination. And that takes place when we go into the life aspect of the solar logos. But without the sharpest discrimination, we will not know what is alive and what is dead. And that's life. After the fourth degree, look, it's very interesting. At the fourth degree, you die so you can live. It reminds me of a song. We will die that we may live. So you leave behind through death the cosmic dense physical body of the soul of Logos, and you enter the cosmic etheric body of the soul of Logos, and you become a living being. That's what the discrimination is all about at that point.
So can you explain that to me? So at fourth initiation, you would achieve that through the death of this physical body.
Well, the death of the causal body, which destroys at the same time the whole personality, including the physical body. I think that, you know, I'm getting the feeling that this light is going out on this. I think we're going to have to tell Johnny. It looks a bit gray to me. But anyway, this is destroyed. That's the death of the causal body, taking with it everything below, and the volatile essence, which you are, flies in Egyptian mythology onto the Buddhic plane, where it is now free in the life of God. So you end, and basically what happens at that time is you free yourself from the previous solar system. You free yourself from the influence of the previous solar system. I think that's very, very, very interesting. And in the judgment day that is happening right now, which is that little anticipation of the judgment day to come, the opportunity to free ourselves from materialism is presented. It's on a lower turn of the spiral. But you can see how the fourth degree initiate is also freeing himself from materialism. What is that materialism? It's the cosmic, dense, physical plane. That's materialism, as far as the soul of Logos is concerned. And that's why we only come alive at the fourth degree. And the way to get there is to pass through apparent death. We die to a world which was killing us, and we are born into a world in which we will live. That's our goal. That's our objective. Once we achieve that, we can be trusted. Once you achieve the victory over the world, the flesh, and the devil in the desert, you can sort of be trusted. At least you're not a hazard. You're not a liability. At least you probably will keep going, almost certainly. But you still have many faults. But once you've achieved the fourth degree, you are so close to becoming a perfected human being. Perfected. As a matter of fact, the number four rules the term perfection. Take a look here. On the... Come to it already, please. There we go. Take a look at these cities. Look at the... Atmic plane. The fourth level, fourth again, right? Of the Atmic plane is called perfection. So our fourth initiation is perfection. But the total radiance of the perfected being is achieved at the fifth initiation of mastership. And by the time you're a sixth degree initiate, you're not considered a man anymore. They are no longer men as are the masters. But having passed beyond that lesser stage and have linked themselves to the great council in the highest secret place. No longer men as are the masters. The perfected man is the number five, the master. Totally radiant in his perfection. By the time you reach the fourth degree, you're almost there, except to clear away the debris of the causal body so you can shine. That's really, I think, what goes on between the fourth degree and the fifth degree is the clearing away of the debris of the supernova. So you become a radiant sun, unobscured by the clouds of your former limitation. Okay. We're almost there, then we can eat again. You know, every once in a while it doesn't hurt to say, although I find it hard to deal with, that Master DK says we eat four times more than we should. Mm-hmm. He's very specific. He doesn't say three, he doesn't say two, he doesn't say five, he says four. As long as we're on the number four. I mean, I just crossed my mind. That would be quite a... And I imagine by eating four times more than we should, we somehow obscure our energy.
Slow ourselves down.
We slow ourselves down, we dampen our energy, we are less vital, and we make sharing impossible. Mm. I think we have to get over it. Mm. Anybody up for this?
Mm. We soon may have to be up for it.
I think so. But not when we're at Humlakor. Because the table at Humlakor is not a 4+ table, it's an 8+ table. And you know, it's a bit hard to teach your element, your astral and physical elemental not to like what's there. Now, your mental elemental learns much more easily. You know, but when it comes to the battle at the table between your mental elemental and your astral physical elemental, we know what usually wins. So I'll be keeping my eye on you and on me. See how we do for dinner. Okay, the revelation of the form of God. By distinguishing between the soul and the form, and by a vision of the perfection of glory, which can radiate from the forms, indwelt by God, he learns the way of light and to see his form and all forms as custodians of the light. And so, you know, not even custodians, not only custodians, but as the light. Forms are light, aren't they? So the first step is to see the forms as holding, expressing, somehow containing the light. And the next step is to see the forms as the light themselves. And so DK says, so he buckles down, no matter what, to the work of making the astral body simply a reflector of that light. And by the quelling of desire, meaning, you know, you kind of subdue it, even snuff it, through the subjugation of the Agni Suryans, we are the ruler, they are the servant, who constitute his astral body and are the living substance of the astral plane. So here he's including them, he's including elemental life. He's in, you know, sometimes when he uses the term Agni Suryans, he doesn't just mean the evolutionary devas. Sometimes he includes all the substance of the astral plane. He learns to function as an adept on that plane, to pierce through its illusion, and to see life true. This is the ending of glamour. At least the ending of the worst glamours at the second initiation. So basically, DK is telling us how to get a hold of the astral body, subdue its tendencies, subject it to the mind held steady in the light. That's what he's saying.
It's amazing, so, really. The age is a great opportunity for that. Because
yes.
The desire body cools as one gets older. And it just struck me that it's a time of great opportunity to make an enormous leap.
Yes, it is. It is. You know, Master Moria has often said something to this effect, the worse the better. So when we have very, very challenging circumstances, the gain may be considerable. But we as the personality, we may not want to pass through that. And I think that'll be a moment of discrimination for us too. In other words, let's discriminate. What am I identified with? Am I identified with the instrument undergoing stress, or am I identified with the inner consciousness really learning something because this is happening? So we'll have that chance. Every one of us will have that chance. Sooner or later, you know, if you're not having a crisis, why not? So, okay? Speaking symbolically, the substance of the astral plane is animated by three types of divine force, which, when brought together, produce the great illusion. Okay, so here we're talking about here the production of the great illusion. Okay. Why not? Great illusion. Production. The first is the force of selfish desire. This involutionary energy plays a big part in bringing about evolution, for selfishness is the nursery of infant souls. Hence, the aspirant who doesn't want to be an infant soul anymore refuses to be held by selfishness. Well, why is selfishness useful? Practically considered.
So that you could center yourself.
At least that. And get some degree of control, right? Because, you know, which would you rather be? A nice, harmless, you know, at least ineffectual, undirected kind of person who could not do anything in the world, but just was sort of made to go here and there by greater powers? Or would you rather be a power within yourself for a while, even if centered on yourself? So in other words, let's look at it astrologically. The movement from Cancer to
Leo.
Leo, the sign of preliminary selfishness. Or Leo, the sign of preliminary centered selfishness. Anyway, it's useful. So, you know, sometimes if you would take people's selfishness away from them, you would do harm. Because they have at least an organizing principle whereby they can control certain energies. That organizing principle is this: I am important. And that is important for a while. Now, obviously, as an aspirant, we can't go with that for too long, can we? Then we are subjected, as an aspirant, the thing that many Leos don't like, as an aspirant, we are subjected to one of the D's. See, so in other words, but you know, you can't be decentralized until you have a center. So we go from this kind of diffuse condition of centeredlessness to centered, to decentralization. And you know, this is even worked out in the sky in a funny kind of way. Compare the constellation Cancer to the constellation Leo. What do you see? If you've looked up at the constellation of the Crab compared with the constellation of the Lion, how do they appear? Now, I'll tell you what, you've got to take Nicholas out and tell him to point out the Lion and the Crab. And the thing is that you will hardly be able to see the Crab. It's so faint. It's so amorphous. It's almost like in the last solar system it was brighter. When you look at the Lion, there it is, there's Regulus, there's the Nebula, there's a clear outline, everything is bold and clear. And the Crab, where is it? Diffuse. So consciousness, in mass consciousness, doesn't have that clear center. You just kind of go along with the crowd, and you're not the individual at all. Now you become the individual, and you move into the stage of selfishness, which means you get control over your vehicles, even if it's for limited purposes. It's very important. But people like ourselves, we have to face our lion in the cave, and the higher lion, in a way, who is Hercules, has to defeat the lower lion. We have to look at those places where we are, you know, self-centered, proud, separative, all that. We have to fight our hydra. Okay, now, so what's going on in the astral plane? What produces the great illusion? This is what we're looking at. What is producing the great illusion? Now, in one way, the whole universe is the great illusion. The most profound Indian philosophers would say that. It's nothing but the great Mahamaya, everything. But, you know, reducing it down a few steps, the astral plane is the plane of the great illusion. And so, and you know, and VK says people want to be psychic. He said, why would you expose yourself to a dimension of life which is utterly chaotic and powerful and illusory when you can't even manage your physical plane life? He says. So, like I said, we were talking about that this morning. We have to work ourselves up from the ethers before we're going to attack the astral plane. In other words, we have to make sure that our astral body, our etheric body, is not going to be the carrier of chaotic astral force. It has to be the carrier of light from the soul through the mind, and then we can attack the astral plane. In other words, if you try to dissipate glamour and you are not a fairly illumined, mentally focused person, you cannot do it. So that's our first step. Clean up the ethers through alignment with the soul. Now, there is an alignment DK always talks about. It's soul, mind, brain. What happened to the astral body? He manages to discount it, because the real effective thing for people of our type is to get that soul, mind, brain lined up. And then we can tackle the great illusion, the most chaotic, dangerous, confusing, misleading, distorting arena of our life. So, you know, on our planet, a lot of people have a good mind and an astral body that doesn't keep pace with their mind. Have you noticed that? Have you noticed that? It's often true. The mind is way ahead of where the astral body is. And you know why? It's the same with our planetary logos. Our planetary logos has personal problems, centered around an astral vehicle which has not yet measured up, but it's almost getting there. So basically, two planets are fighting for control of our planetary logos' astral body. Can you think of which they are? It's not too hard.
Venus
is one.
Mars
is the other. Right? Venus and Mars are at war in almost every person's astral body, and it is so as well for the planetary logos. It's a very Martian area. But he says an interesting thing. He said that at the end of World War II, Mars in relation to Scorpio or in relation to the astral plane or both reached its height of power. So the possibility of pulling back from the Martian influence on the astral body is very strong, and Venus has to come in under Libra, and the whole rise of the feminine influence is part of that changing of the astral body under the Venus quality. It will be what you call a much more civilized astral body, carrying the second ray of Venus rather than the sixth ray of Mars. So we really need, you know, Venus is a calm planet. And when you see people influenced by Venus, they have a kind of a beautiful calmness and about them, very attractive, very different from the agitation of Mars. So that's one of the battles we're fighting right now. And when people have in their astrological chart a square, a conjunction, an opposition between Venus and Mars, you can apply it to the astral plane and you can apply it to soul and personality. It's not just men and women. It's a whole dynamic in their inner psyche between turbulence, aggression, and all the violent emotions compared to the serenity and beauty and magnetism of Venus. Okay, so we're talking about what creates the great illusion, and the first thing is selfish desire, and then after we take, let's just do a little bit of this and then we'll take our break. I don't want to send you off to have Danish until we've talked about fear.
I'm thinking about the myth about Venus and Mars and Mars.
Yes, yes.
Venus is designed to be with Mars, but she is married to Vulcan.
Yes.
When she discovered that she is really married to Vulcan.
She's married to Vulcan.
She gets the will of Venus. The first desire finds the will.
Yeah,
that's a symbolic way of telling you.
Exactly.
This.
Exactly. It's love and will instead of lower love and desire. Even Mercury gets into the act somehow. I forget exactly what he does, but it's. Is it Vulcan that catches Venus and Mars in his net? Is that what happens?
Yes.
All those jealous husbands, you know.
Yes.
He catches them, you know. And then, you know, it's like saying, it's like a marriage out of duty or something. An arranged marriage or something. She thinks Mars is pretty good looking and Vulcan is not so good to look at, but after all, she settles for stability. Of course, it never happens in real life. Okay, the force of fear. This is the product of ignorance. And in its initial stages is not the product of wrong thinking. Ignorance and fear go together. Okay. It is basically instinctual and is found dominating in non-mental animal kingdom as well as the human kingdom. So fear at first is not based on mind. But of course you can make your fears worse by thinking about them in certain ways. But in the human, its power is increased potently through the powers of the mind and through memory of past pain and grievance and through anticipation of those we foresee. The power of fear is enormously aggravated by the thought form we ourselves have built of our own individual fears and phobias.
When he talks about past pain, is he talking about in other incarnations?
I'm sure it's there's a residual instinctual recoil against unremembered events in past lives. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go there. I don't know why, I just don't want to go there, that kind of thing. And then there's the remembered events of this life.
Right.
And then we dwell on them and we magnify them and we brood. The past was bad. The future is liable to be bad, maybe worse. The past was really bad. Oh, the future is going to be much worse. And you know, we start building up a negative loop here until we have a dread of the future and a recoil from the past. But actually, you know, there's an interesting thing here. It strikes me. What would happen if we lived in the now? What would happen to fear? Because we would not be dwelling on past grievances and we would not be having forebodings about the future. We would be in the Buddhic consciousness, which casts out all fear. Perfect love, as it is said. So I haven't followed this man who's been speaking about the power of now, kind of, he looks like to me like a German metaphysician, you know. Eckhart Tolle. He looks to me like an old monk who's now lecturing about something he has achieved. but I think that there is a peace that passeth understanding. It abides in the hearts of those who live in the eternal. So where is the fear in that? So I think that this whole question about learning to live in the eternal, and how do you do that? You know, how do you live in the eternal? And I would say, it's a meditation for a whole lifetime. But I would say intensify the presence via Buddhic energy. Because if the presence is intense enough, it commands so much attention that it forces you to live in the now. So if we intensify this sense of the vivid energy of the presence, it's so arresting of consciousness that we don't have time to go wandering back in memory, foreboding forward. We're in this vivid, immediate, even energetically overpowering presence. It forces the now upon us, I think. But you can, you know, find your own solution, how it works for you. When have you been overcome by the presence? And if you have been overcome by the presence, didn't you find it very attention-getting? You know, where else were you focusing your mind when the presence is making itself present? Nowhere else, I would suggest. So think about that and see how you would overcome this through the power of the now.
Because coming into the presence, there are so much expansion.
Yes.
And you.
Yes.
You see the whole thing, the whole picture. So the little world of the personality straight up being important.
And it seems to take in the interesting thing about the now, which becomes eternal, is that it begins to take up the space of the past and the space of the future. It begins to extend itself in time. And not just in space, but in time. It seems to start absorbing the past as if it's not real. And also, it absorbs the future as if it always existed. So it has its own special quality which eats up the past and the future. You know, it's hard to talk about this logically because it ends up being a paradox in a way. But I would think that if we take that mantra seriously, there is a peace that passeth understanding and abides in the hearts of those who live in the eternal. There is a power that maketh all things new. It lives and moves in those who know the self as one. So I would suggest that to overcome these fears, we simply live in the eternal and know the self as one. Which, you know, talk about a lifetime of meditation focused on those things. But I believe it will overcome the usual fear response. That is my guess.
Is it desire fades out, because there is nothing to desire. All is there.
Yeah. The seeker and the sought are one.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the sixth mantra for soul fulfillment. This thought form grows in power, the scary one, as we pay attention to it, for energy follows thought till we become dominated by it. Now, I put this in red because I figured it was significant. Second-ray people are peculiarly a prey to this, to nursing their fears until they become mega-fears, you know, until they are consumed by fear and paralyzed. So, you know, there's this old saying that a coward dies a thousand times before his death, a hero dies but once. This, you know, this nursing of the fear in anticipation of pain. Well, why? Because the second-rate types are so sensitive that naturally they feel it more. They don't have a skin of cast iron like some have. And so naturally they dread the impact, which is felt far more potently than some other types feel. But every ray has its liabilities.
It also has to do with repetition. This repetition, this limit units, is your limitation of being forced to the
repetition. Yeah.
It can be a phobia, we have an idea.
Exactly.
So
the whole thing,
forced to do it all the time.
The whole thing just gets blown out of proportion. And we dwell on a thing so much we fail to see what it really is. Master Moria has a perspective on this. He says, death, well, you should consider it as if you were cutting one of your hairs. This is his perspective on death. It's not exactly the second-rate perspective, is it? How much pain is involved in taking one hair and cutting it? Not a whole lot of pain, is there? That's his first-rate perspective on how to consider death. Obviously, he's been through it a few times, but he says he was rarely killed through failing to observe. He says, watch out, it's the little things that give away your assassin. So if someone's going to kill you, they will reveal themselves by little things. So he says he was rarely surprised by such things. Maybe just a few times. You know, when you're a leader, when you're in the first ray, you always have to watch out for someone who wants your position. Mm-hmm. Someone who wants to use Pluto to eliminate you. Okay.
To me, it's a great pain to cut a hair.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it's a very relative thing. Some of us have died many times. Okay. For the majority of these second-ray people, fear constitutes the dweller on the threshold, just as ambition and love of power, backed by frantic desire and unscrupulousness, form the dweller for the first-ray types. Whoa. In other words, what we're saying here is, I will do anything to get where? To the top. Anything. Frantic desire, that's interesting. I've never seen that one applied to the first ray. The crystallized thought form of intellectual achievement for selfish ends and the use of knowledge, you know what's coming now, and the use of knowledge for personality objectives stand before the portal of the path in the case of the third ray person. And unless broken up and destroyed, will dominate and turn him into a black magician.
Ooh.
Ooh. The ray structure of your average black magician is as follows. Third ray monad, first ray soul. That's what I've pieced together from what he said, because they are mostly initiates of the previous solar system where the third ray was dominant. And those who came into our solar system from the previous solar system have by and large the third ray monad, maybe exclusively so, and elsewhere he says that the black magician has the first ray soul. The great majority of them has the first ray soul. Well, let's take a little break and we'll come back to more fear and illusion. Thank you.